This is a very good turnout for question time. I did think there might be a few questions after that. So George is going to come around, my lovely assistant, with a microphone. And you can ask your question. You can ask your questions to either of us. So feel free to do that.
Ask questions to Mike.
But first question, please.
Can I ask about the Matthew Exceptive Clause, please?
The Matthew Exception Clause?
Yeah.
Yep.
What do you want to ask about?
The assumption that it doesn't allow you remarriage.
Yeah.
Why? It doesn't say that in the Bible.
It so in the passage we'll be looking at, Matthew 19, verse 9, I tell you the truth, that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery. That verse grammatically could allow for either of what I would say are the sort of main interpretations amongst people who want to submit to what the Bible says. There are all manner of interpretations for people who, you know, doing other things. I would say that verse taken in isolation could mean, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery, unless there was unfaithfulness involved, in which case they can divorce and remarry. It could mean that. But it could equally mean, grammatically, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, unless I'm allowing the exception for marital unfaithfulness, in which case the divorce is legitimate, that there is a time when a Christian can acquiesce in the face of a persistently unfaithful spouse, that they're not bound to keep on hammering away at the marriage if the spouse is determined to break it. So Jesus is granting permission for divorce. But in all cases of divorce, whether legitimate or illegitimate, nevertheless, marrying another woman is an adulterous act. Now, grammatically, it could mean either of those. And we could go into the Greek of it if you want, but basically it could mean either. So you have to ask a broader question. Well, which one of those interpretations does Jesus intend us to receive? I've argued that he intends us to understand that divorce is sometimes legitimate, but remarriage isn't during the lifetime of a former spouse, for two reasons. One, looking backwards, because if it's the Creator who joins in marriage, then other scriptures make it clear that only death ends a marriage in the sight of God. Romans 7 verses 1 and 2, 1 Corinthians 7 verse 39 and 40, for instance, talk about a couple being married until death, and it is death that ends the marriage bond and renders the widow or widower free to remarry. That's explicit in the Bible. There's the looking back to the Creator as the one who joins a couple together, and we learn from other scriptures that only God can undo that in death. But also looking forward, as I said just briefly at the end, the disciples' reaction to Jesus' teaching indicates that he said something new here. He hasn't simply aligned himself to one of the schools of thought in contemporary first century Judaism, but as so often, has gone beyond and said something radically different, which is why they react in this appalled way. If that's what you say, it's better not to get married at all. Why take the risk? Now their reaction, I would say, is further evidence that it should be interpreted that way. That's the second thing. Third thing to say is, if you look in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul, who clearly has familiarity with Jesus' teaching on marriage and divorce, and in particular the exception clause in Matthew 19, Paul says, this is 1 Corinthians, page 1148, 1 Corinthians 7 verses 10 and 11, to the married I give this command, not I but the Lord, in which he's referring back to Jesus' own teaching. I'll just give the reference again, 1 Corinthians 7 verse 10, to the married I give this command, not I but the Lord, a wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and a husband must not divorce his wife. And separation and divorce, although very clearly distinct in our understanding, in our culture, in Jesus and Paul's teaching, not nearly so clearly distinguished. So what Paul does is he says, well, you shouldn't separate, but if you do, in other words, if separation stroke divorce occurs, then these are the two options: remain unmarried or be reconciled. And so because he, as it were, pushes through the implication in that way, he doesn't say remain unmarried or be reconciled or get married to someone else. He says, no, these are the two choices that a person is left with in this situation. where they've become separated from, legitimately or illegitimately, their spouse. So, in a nutshell, that's the reason I end up concluding from Matthew 19, verse 9, that although that verse in and of itself could be taken either way, the immediate context and the broader biblical context would lead us to conclude that remarriage during the lifetime of a former spouse is not what God teaches is right. That was a long answer. Does that help you to at least understand why I've said it, even if it doesn't satisfy you as an answer? Feel free to have a follow-up if you want to.
I might have an alternative perspective on this.
I know you do, Glenn, because we've talked about it before, but feel free, go on.
Because it's an interpretation, there is an alternative way of reading it. And would that not be fair that a fair amount of the church has actually accepted that the alternative view is equally valid?
Well, it's always, I mean, all of the Bible has to be interpreted. We're looking at a particularly painful and difficult issue tonight, but everything God's word says is in human language, and human language has to be interpreted. Sometimes one has to rule out of court certain interpretations as being entirely invalid. At other times, and Paul says this, doesn't he, in places like Romans 14, he talks about, well, take another issue entirely unrelated to marriage and divorce. Paul gives the example there of how Christians will view the Sabbath. Some Christians will have a very strict Sabbath understanding that will not be seen in the co-op on a Sunday afternoon. Whereas others, equally doing Bible interpretation, would have a very different view of what the Sabbath is and would quite happily go and buy carrots for the Sunday roast in the co-op on a Sunday afternoon. Now that's an example that Paul gives there of an issue where there are two interpretations, and he wants to say explicitly that actually Christians shouldn't fall out with one another even if they come to different conclusions. So it's a matter of wisdom. You know, when is an interpretation within the acceptable spectrum that Christians can disagree, and when, you know, you get the old Bishop of Durham up and say he doesn't think that Jesus really rose bodily from the dead, well, most of us, I don't think, would feel free to, well, it's just his interpretation, so that's okay. You know, there are some interpretations that are clearly out of court, and there are others that are to be accepted, and working out on any particular issue how we should regard interpretations different from our own is something that requires a great deal of humility and grace and forbearance. I would say, which is why I said this in the sermon, that on this particular issue of whether or not somebody could remarry after divorce, if they've divorced for the reason Jesus says, I would say is one where actually Christians need to accept that one another may have, you know, we may have different conclusions on it. Doesn't mean that in the end, you know, we aren't actually pretty convinced that we understand it rightly, but that for the sake of grace and brotherly love, we accept one another with our differences. Shall we come on to another question? Is that all right? You're happy? Yeah, we move on to another. Let's have another question. Yep, Paul over here.
So just really sticking on that a bit, Mike. We say unless the partner's been unfaithful. Now, what do you... I mean, I've got an interpretation of that, and I wonder what is the right interpretation?
Of unfaithfulness?
Yes.
The Greek word, and this may answer your question, is porneia, from which we get the word pornography. It's a word that speaks of sexual unfaithfulness. It is not the word for adultery, which also exists in Greek, moikeia, and which and Matthew elsewhere talks about porneia and moikeia, adultery and this word unfaithfulness, so he distinguishes between them. It seems to be a deliberately broad word, but limited to the sexual arena. So, for instance, it might be that a person has taken up, you know, with a same-sex partner, or is indulging of some other manner of, you know, let's not contemplate it, but some other manner of sexual unfaithfulness, of which there are many kinds. But it does seem to be that there's a sexual content to the unfaithfulness that's important. And I think that does link within Matthew 19 very much back to this one flesh nature of what marriage is in God's purposes. that our sexual relationship in marriage is in a sense the essence of it, in the sense that it both symbolizes and seals what marriage is in God's sight, and therefore an assault on that is an assault on the very core of what marriage is. So I think that's the reason it comes in there. The other thing just to say is I think the reason that Matthew gives the exception and Mark doesn't, because in both Mark and Luke records of Jesus teaching on this subject, there is no exception clause. It's only in Matthew. I think the reason it's likely to be there is because there is a character in Matthew's narrative who is a righteous man who seeks a divorce. Who is, of course? Who's the one righteous man in Matthew's gospel who seeks divorce? We just had the Christmas story. Joseph. Exactly. Matthew's the only gospel that records Joseph, and because he was a righteous man, wants to divorce Mary, whom he thinks has been sexually unfaithful. So it does seem to make logical sense that the reason it crops up here in Matthew is because Matthew is a consistent author. No doubt Jesus actually said it, but that there is a particular sense in which Joseph's integrity is in view in the broader canvas. That's another question. Oh, Annabelle, not moving very far.
Can I go back to 1 Corinthians 7?
You may.
And just a little bit further on from where you were in verses 10 and 11. The next few verses talk about an unbelieving husband being sanctified through his wife and vice versa. But then if you go on to verse 15...
I'd like you to explain that to me, actually. But
well, no, I can't. Really, but if the unbeliever leaves, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean? Is that implying that you can divorce if your unbelieving spouse leaves?
Yes, I think it is. And in that sense, it's more an acquiescing to what has already in practice occurred. So even if the paperwork hasn't been done, the unbelieving spouse has just gone, you know, and has disappeared. And so in that sense, it can be formalized, I think Paul is saying, in terms of a divorce. So what people would classically do is say that there are two New Testament grounds for divorce, the adult sexual unfaithfulness, Matthew 19, and the desertion, here from 1 Corinthians 7. But again, the rub comes in how you understand then that verse 15, a believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. You see, I would argue that what that means is that the believer is not bound to keep on trying to pursue a spouse who no longer wants anything to do with them, so they may be free from the obligations of the marriage in God's sight because of the unfaithfulness of their partner, in this case by desertion. George would argue that actually the not being bound means therefore being free to remarry.
Can we hear it from George?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I said in the sermon. Very happy to. George, tell it like you see it.
I think what Mike said about, you know, when you're looking at a New Testament text, looking at the grammar, and it could go either way, and actually what you're looking for is an overarching theology of the Bible, a way of seeing things, and that's where we differ. And what you've heard Mike explain is an indissolubilist view, in that when people get married, become one flesh, it's like one human being. It's like when a child is born, it is part of both parents in it. You cannot tear it apart to kill the child. But that's the sort of language that is indissoluble marriage view. Am I being fair?
Yeah.
So if there's divorce that's happened, that's torn something apart, and you cannot sort of go on and remarry. Okay, so that's not the view I hold. The view I hold is that marriage is a covenant, that it is something, and I get that from the language throughout the Bible of God's covenant with his people, and how that's always compared to the marriage covenant. And we've got lots and lots in the Bible about what covenant is like, what God's covenant is like. And so the first thing I'd lay on that is that if we're in a marriage relationship, it's a testimony to God's relationship with his people. So what we do with it dishonors him if we reject what we're testifying to. So I'm probably, in terms of application, I'm not that far away from Mike. Theologically, I'm quite different, but actually I'm probably going to say most of the time for that reason. But a covenant is different in nature from saying one flesh, isn't it? A covenant can be broken. God's covenant has been broken by human beings. and we are in a position where we're irredeemable, and that needed his son to come and redeem us. So a covenant can be broken, and by nature, if it's been broken, divorce and remarriage go to, you know, that once you're divorced, you can be remarried. You're not in a state where something's been torn apart and killed. Because it's a bond, it's a legal bond, with all the import that the Bible gives it, it can be broken, but not easily. And hence, divorce is an issue of what's a bond-breaking issue, what's a bond-breaking sin in the covenant of God. And one of those things would be the sexual unfaithfulness category, the desertion category, and possibly a third category of neglect, which I get from a book by... I'm influenced greatly by a man called David Instone Brewer, who's is an intertestamental scholar, an expert on rabbinic tradition. That's what he did, all the 400 years between the Old and New Testament. He's an expert on all of the things that the Pharisees read, which were wrong-headed. But that's what they used, and that's what's helpful when you're looking at Matthew 19. These people are well versed in those protocols, and he's speaking into that context. So that's the background they have. So what he says has that kind of background, and they made an awful lot of Exodus 21 verse 10, and whether neglect could be a category into which, and that's the Shammai position. I broadly think that Jesus endorses the Shammai position with a bit more. I mean, I don't think it's entirely Shammai position. Okay, that's sort of what I'm coming from. Is that helpful?
Yeah, well, Fran, do you want George to say any more? You asked him to speak. Okay. Let's come on to the next question. Are you, Susan? Oh, sorry, there was a hand behind there. Let's go. You're both giving way. Go on, we'll come to you then. Come on.
So where did you get your view to allow to remarry? I can see the authority to get divorced, but I can't see anywhere in Scripture that says to remarry, because there's, you know, in Matthew 5:31, it talks about not remarrying. So,
yeah,
it's a view that then absolves you free to remarry. There's a view that shows you that you can divorce. There's a view that shows you can divorce, but the remarry bit, I don't know where you get the authority to. Implied. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. If you read Deuteronomy 24, it presumes that once divorced, you can remarry. Actually, Deuteronomy 24 is about a very specific situation in which someone is divorced, remarried, not allowed to marry again the person you originally divorced from. It's not a general rule at all. It's very, very narrow in its application. Moses is just trying to cover a gap which is opened up. But in all of the ancient Near East, divorce presumed near remarriage. In all of rabbinic Judaism, divorce presumed remarriage. The background into which Jesus is speaking, divorce presumes remarriage. And it's what you take that background, what Jesus is saying about that background, and Mike takes it that he's sort of saying no to all of it. And I'm saying, well, no, actually, there's a covenantal view that's going on through the whole Bible, which has been building up throughout as God reveals how he relates to his people. And I'm saying that, yes, it's very, very serious. Just as Mike said, it's one flesh. It's a testimony to who God is and what he's like. But actually, it can be broken. God divorces his people in Jeremiah 4. And then he shows his grace in immense and wonderful ways. And that example should challenge us never not to go there. That's sort of where I'm going. Yeah.
I think just on this, though, I'm not sure we... just to keep the points of agreement as well. The very fact that Jesus talks about at least illegitimate divorce... if it's followed by remarriage, that remarriage is adulterous. That's his language. So you would agree that he's reshaping the category of what divorce does, at least for those who are illegitimately divorced, in a way that his hearers would have struggled with, in a way that we do, frankly. Is that fair?
Yeah, the rabbinic code was just all, how can I get away with this? That's the attitude of it, and he completely kicks that attitude out.
I think the other thing I'd want to say as well... we would both agree that that marriage is covenantal. I would argue that that's not the primary biblical designation for it. I wouldn't say that it's not covenantal, but in a sense, the covenantal point I would want to make is that in the end, God never does abandon his people. So you mentioned about Jeremiah, but Isaiah 54, verse 7, "For a brief moment I abandoned you, but with deep compassion I will bring you back." So I would argue that actually the... To take what George has called the indissolubilist position, marriage only ended by death, actually is a witness in the end to God's never ultimately abandoning his church, his bride. Yes, he does. He uses the language of divorce in Jeremiah 4 or abandonment in Isaiah 54, but he takes her back. He's reconciled to her. So in the end, that bond between God and his people, Christ and the church, is never severed. So in the end, we're both actually arguing a covenantal thing, and we're both linking it perhaps in slightly different emphases to the bigger story of what's going on in the Bible. So I'm sorry to have it. I mean, in a sense, I think it's helpful. I hope you find it helpful that we can have this discussion in front of you, because, you know, as Christians, we need to work out what God's word said. I'm not the Pope. You know, you don't want to follow my interpretation. Our aim in preaching God's word to you is to help you hear what God says and to receive it yourselves, to work out these things. And it's necessary that we do that. Dave's hand. Oh, no, sorry, Suzanne was going to come. And then we'll have... Yeah, forgot. Sorry, Suzanne.
I've just got a question about if a woman is faithful to her husband, but her husband either domestically or sexually abuses her, and that she's in danger of her life, like what kind of answer would, what should she do, sort of thing?
Yes. That is a very hard question to answer in general terms, I think. I think I'd want to say two things, which may sound opposite, and this is why it kind of depends on the situation. One would be that if someone is in fear of their life, then it clearly to flee from that situation is not going to find condemnation from any sane or civilized human being. And I don't imagine that, we don't have a specific example, I don't imagine Jesus would condemn such a person for fleeing under those circumstances. So I'd want to say that initially. But I would also want to say, and this is particularly true if you look, for instance, at 1 Peter, that it is intrinsic to Christian faith and the living out of Christian faith in human relationships that suffering is a part of it. Whether it's in marriage, whether it's in your relationship to an overbearing state, whether it's in your relationship to an unscrupulous employer. And Peter keeps telling the Christians there, who are suffering in the most dreadful ways, to bear up under it and look to Christ in his suffering rather than running away. So I think, you know, I want to sort of get to both, really. But clearly there has to be a time to flee when nothing else can be done. But at the same time, as Christians, this is hard for all of us, living largely in comfortable surroundings and many of us in happy relationships, but actually to cultivate a mindset that says, just as Christ suffered, so actually we need to learn that suffering will be intrinsic. And I think that's hard to hear in any situation, but it's particularly discordant in our culture that says if you're not happy, just get out. And that if you're not happy, then you shouldn't stay in whatever relationship or obligation it is, just move on. That actually the Christian is starting from a very, very different starting place. Which will be countercultural. Yep, no, go on, George. Let's have a follow-up.
So it's kind of related a little bit. So what if your husband's making you do things that are illegal or in God's sight are wrong? And then this is more about marriage, really, but if the duty of the wife is to submit, like how... Mm-hmm. Is that a ground for divorce, or not divorce, but separation, I guess, if you're being made to do, I don't know, some fraud or whatever it is? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Easy to say, isn't it? But I mean, where Peter says we must obey God rather than men in Acts 5, that surely has, you know, our fundamental loyalty is always to Christ rather than to our spouse. Spouse comes second, at least. Under that primary heading, and so if there's a conflict of loyalty there, then ultimately loyalty to Christ should triumph, must triumph. Okay. Should we go to Dave? Sorry, does that answer your question? Yeah, okay, that's all right, let's go to Dave.
If we got different views within the church, then how should the church respond when it comes to marrying people? You know, a divorcee wants to get married in the church.
Mm.
Well, I can answer that. Sorry. I submit to Mike's authority, so he's right.
Yeah, well, until about 10 years ago, the situation was clear at the formal level in the Church of England, in that in an uninterrupted policy from the time that Christianity came to Britain, early Middle Ages, through the Reformation, uninterrupted, up until about 10 years ago, the Church in this country did not remarry those who had a former spouse still living, at a level of its formal policy, what it said it believed and would stick by. Now, sorry?
Church?
Just the Church of England.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the Church of England, both before the Reformation and after, that was a policy that didn't change, didn't remarry divorcees. In practice, ever since the divorce law change in the 1850s, although the Church of England hadn't changed its policy, a clergyman could remarry someone who'd been divorced, and there were a trickle of those in the 19th century. I mean, we're talking, you know, count them on your fingers of a couple of hands sort of cases. That carried very gradually increasing through the 20th century until the 1960s, when it began to escalate, until the time when the Church of England was debating all this 10 years ago, something like 20% of marriages in Church of England churches involved a divorcee, even though officially the church said that could never happen. So it was becoming clearly a nonsensical situation, because you've got on the one hand what the Church of England taught and what the law said, and the law says George and I are registrars and therefore we can marry anybody who's legally entitled to get married, and someone who's divorced is legally entitled to get married in this country. So plenty of clergy did it in their churches. The Church of England recognised this was a mess and so changed its policy to make it more messy, because basically what it said was, rather than having a clear policy, which a lot of people aren't following, they devolved the decision to parish ministers, which people like me actually made life a lot harder, because I used to be able to say the Church of England teaches this and has done for 1400 years. You know, you may find that plenty of parishes choose not to follow what the church teaches, but actually the church teaches this and we stick to it. Now we have to say, I'm sorry, it's just me that's causing you the problem. So be it. They come up with a raft of rules regulating those who were to be remarried after a divorce, which included, I thought, some very odd things, like you can have a church wedding if you've been divorced twice but not three times. Where did they get that from? So the woman at the well, presumably the first two weddings could have been Church of England, but the next three not. I mean, you get into this kind of human rules and regulations very quickly once you start legislating for it. I can't remember what your question was now, David, but I'm just rambling.
You were saying there was a difference between you and George.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Therefore, how does it work out in practice if there are different positions? Yeah.
Well, as George says, in practice, every parish minister makes their own policy, and any colleagues who work with that vicar or rector will follow his policy. So, given my understanding, I have a clear policy, always have done. We don't remarry those here who've got a former spouse still living. But we don't, and because of the earlier conversation about, you know, accepting one another in brotherly love who come to different conclusions, we don't make any issue of it for those who are remarried at all, because we're all sinners, we all stand in need of grace. Wherever we're up to, it's as a result of some mess that we've got ourselves into. So, you know, it's not as if we get into a question of poking into people's lives at all. But in terms of actually marrying people here, no, it only those who've never married or are widowed. We have another question. Come back to Paul. Oh, it was Paul over there, I saw.
Okay, you must get some difficult situations to handle.
Yes, you know, not least about half a dozen people a year who ring up completely out of the blue, not in the congregation, and who want to get married here, and who wonder where one or the other has been divorced. And that's it's a dreadful first encounter.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, we've probably all met Christian couples who have really struggled in their marriage. Mm. Yeah, and they try and they try and they try. You get to the point. Well,
I have pictures in my mind. Yes,
yeah,
go
okay.
on. Yeah.
I mean, how do we sort of help advise these people? And in the end, is really a divorce a satisfactory, or something which can be condoned, or I can't think of the right words here, but I think you probably understand what I'm saying.
I do.
Could we get to a point where we say, well, actually, yes, it probably is better you get divorced?
It's very easy to feel that very deeply, isn't it? Both as a concerned friend or as a fellow Christian, or sometimes in the couple themselves, desperate to get away from each other in order to find some peace. Yeah, we do, and well, I know, but then the person most likely to murder you in this country is your spouse, statistically. So, you know, you don't have to look very far for your enemy in many homes, do you? So, but this is why I say, yes, I think that's absolutely what we want to try and encourage, isn't it? But in the end, you know, every person has to stand before the Lord, and no one else is in that person's shoes. I think in the end, though, what Jesus says about marriage does mean that persisting in it and constantly coming back for grace and so on is the right thing to do. I think that's where the point I was saying before about suffering being intrinsic to all relationships, but particularly in marriage. I mean, this is true, isn't it? In marriage, we learn we have the most wonderful experience. Those of us who are happily married, of intimacy and so on with another human being, a friendship, and all those things. But we also discover ways to hurt another person and be hurt by them in a way that, frankly, before we were married, we didn't even have a patch on. You know, it is both the heights and the lows of human experience in marriage. There is both great joy and suffering in marriage. No one can hurt you like your spouse does. No one on earth, not your greatest enemy, can do that. So, you know, I think that is, again, I get to get that as the mindset. And I've got people in my mind who are I know exactly what you mean, the sort of person who they've been married 30 years and it's still, you know, pistols at dawn practically every other day. And you weep for such a brother or sister in that situation, and you keep trying to encourage and do what you can. It often takes a lot of help from friends and fellow Christians. But I think to have that, always to have the unchanged goal that no, marriage is marriage until death. And after 30 years, death is a lot nearer than it was at the beginning. So, you know, there's always an end in sight. No, I mean, that sounds flippant, but actually we look for a relationship in the end with the Lord that is in the consummation, not here. Don't we? And I think we've got to have that perspective as well.
Can I just make one comment, as I happen to have the microphone here?
Yeah, of course
here.
You can, Annabelle, yes.
and really that's your comment about suffering, and I think we, when there are marriages where there are children and children are suffering, we have to have a lot of compassion in how we view these and the sort of advice and support we give.
Yes, I wouldn't disagree with that. And there's a world of difference between what you'd say to someone before they've made a cataclysmic decision and afterwards, isn't there? You might want to say to someone who's still married, and there isn't a biblical reason for a divorce, keep plugging at it. But if in the end they don't, and they've gone off and they've married someone else, well then, you know, the new situation is going to need to be met by fresh grace from God in that, isn't it? So, you know, it's always a matter of me to be where they are now. That's what God does, and that's what we need to do as well. Go on, Helen.
I was just going to say, what about separation, not divorce?
Sometimes it's necessary to preserve physical or mental health, it seems to me, but only ever as a deeply temporary measure. Separation often doesn't, you know, begins as a temporary intention and doesn't stay that way. But yeah, if you've got, you know, if the man's about to beat his wife to a pulp, then clearly some measure of separation has got to be factored in.
But is divorce just as a means to be able to get remarried and obviously to settle money and things as well? But which would you advise, permanent separation but not divorce? Or?
Well, what does Paul say? They must either be reconciled or what's this phrase? If she does, he must remain unmarried or be reconciled. So, you know, clearly, it has in view a separation there. So it's clearly, you know, going to happen sometimes. But I'm not sure it's something that a person who really wants to follow the Lord could ever acquiesce in, insofar as it's up to them as a permanent solution. I wonder if it isn't up to one person very often, because the other one's gone off or won't change their ways in order to be livable with, or whatever it might be. So we can only ever try and do what's right for our own behaviour, our own mindset, can't we? We can't ever, even with our spouse, live their life for them or make their decisions for them. And sometimes they will make it impossible to continue. So in that case, I think that's what Paul's got in mind about the staying in a state of separation, if the other person makes it impossible to resume the marriage. Do you want to come back?
No, it's okay. If we are against divorce, but if it's unlivable, then it would seem that a separation, so neither party would remarry at any point, but you wouldn't be living together.
I think that sometimes that becomes the outcome, and it's probably the best of a bad set of choices.
Is it difficult because I've seen the part we know?
Yeah.
And that's the one. Obviously, celibacy and that sort of thing.
Hence all the making eunuch stuff in the end of the Matthew 19 passage. Okay. Another question, Janet, over here. Oh, let's have a microphone. George, on your feet. Come on, lad.
It's not so much a question as just a comment, really. I just want to kind of redress the balance, because we seem to be getting into the realms of extremes. Mm. And I do know of couples where one of the one partner has been unfaithful, and obviously really hurt the other. And yet they have forgiven and have been reconciled. And I would want to say that is certainly... This isn't a Christian couple, actually. Yeah. And so it can happen between non-Christians. So it certainly should, if at all possible, happen between Christians. I would say, that is a very difficult thing. I'm not saying it would be easy. But the world would say, you've been betrayed.
Yeah.
You should divorce. I would want to say... divorce should always be a last resort, and if there is any hope of reconciliation, we should be seeking to encourage people to forgive and to re-establish a marriage.
Can I say that's a very helpful point, particularly because the concession for divorce in Matthew 19 is often seen as something that one, in the sense that then one can do it, whereas actually, even for the person who's been sinned against sexually, offering forgiveness is clearly the gospel priority, isn't it? And it's a concession that divorce would be not necessarily sinful, but not necessarily, and we're not saying it's the necessary thing or the best thing for the Christian in that situation. So if reconciliation is possible, and I can think of a couple just in precisely this situation who are Christians, and there has been forgiveness and has been reconciliation, and that is wonderful. Thing. It's not an easy thing, and it's a long-term, ongoing offer of forgiveness, I think, when there's been that sort of betrayal that needs to be there. Just one other thing on the Matthew 19 thing, I just didn't mention this, but the other reason it's probably there is that both Roman law and Jewish law mandated divorce in the case of adultery. And so Jesus, again, another part of the background is Jesus saying to his disciples, you don't have to become lawbreakers in staying in a marriage with an adulterous spouse. You can divorce them, but even if, as you said, reconciliation is best, you don't have to set yourself up against the law by pursuing the marriage if it becomes clear that the other party doesn't want to repent. Dave, again? Oh, sorry, Danny. Go on. We've got a husband and wife questions thing going on here. Then we'll come to Dave. Then we probably look.
Hello.
Hello, Danny.
30 years, I just wondered if you could say something about what we as the Christian body, the church, can do in terms of minimising couples ever getting to this situation in the first place. So I'm thinking in terms of marriage preparation. I'm thinking in terms of setting examples. I'm thinking in terms of people like us who've been married for 30 years, building friendships with couples who've just got engaged and things like that.
I can't think of anyone like that, can you, Matt?
And seeking to get them off on the right foot, if you see what I mean. Yeah. So that we're doing as much as we possibly can to avoid us ever reaching these, you know, very undesirable situations.
Yeah. I think you've kind of answered your own question, haven't you?
Really.
Which is absolutely right. Which is no, I mean, marriage is something that needs encouragement from every angle, doesn't it? And when you put two sinners together under the same roof, dear me, there needs to be a lot of grace and a lot of within the Christian family, therefore, a lot of encouragement between the generations and amongst peers. So, I agree. Amen. We do try and do marriage preparation for our couples, but it's not a lot. I mean, we do a day. We do a Saturday for all the couples getting married in 1 year, usually earlier in the year. I'm very conscious we could do a lot more. I think we try and meet with the couples we're marrying individually as well, don't we, George, normally?
We do a lot more on request.
Yeah, no, we do. That's right. No, I was going to say, we're very keen to... Oh, yeah, no, we have another work example over here. We've been on George's 98-week marriage preparation course. So. Yes, no, excellent. Now we'll go to Dave.
Essentially the same idea. It's just that we should be supporting, whether the marriage is within church or outside, that people actually know what they're letting themselves in for, because the idea is that people just see films and it's just going to happen like magic. They don't recognise that it's a work act, it's a contract, you've got a give and take, and all. It's the basics.
Yeah.
I mean, a one-day course isn't enough, is it, really?
No, it isn't. But then you probably need a lifetime, don't you, to actually do it?
I know, but
somewhere between a one day and a lifetime, maybe it would be. Yeah.
No, but I mean, is the material there that is not necessarily Christian, but just getting people to explore each other's ideas and thoughts and attitudes, just to think, what's this person you're marrying like?
Oh, no, I agree. Well, when a couple come to me to get to book their wedding, I always give them a book, which is written by a Christian, but is actually not too heavy at all, and it's quite a good practical thing on marriage. It's part of the pack I give to people when they come initially. That plus the day plus conversations and so on. But most of the couples who get married here aren't Christians, or at least not actively living out a Christian life in a discernible way. Let me say that. It sounds slightly less judgmental, but we're often starting from a long way back in terms of a common understanding of these things. But by the same token, people who choose to get married in church these days, even if they're not regular churchgoers, are actually taking a pretty countercultural step. So, you know, that, in that sense, it's quite a positive, quite a positive beginning, really. And we often talk about that with them. You know, you've chosen to get married in church. That's pretty unusual these days. A lot of your friends are doing the whole do it all at the reception venue deal, if they're doing it at all. So that's great. You obviously want to involve God. You know, let's talk about, you know. So there are positive things that you get from reduced numbers, and it being a less common choice these days.